Hello, and welcome back to another episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Arzu, a cancer survivor, as well as cancer champion for the patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. I'm also part of the Cancer Smart Initiative, which is an exciting opportunity to help tackle cancer and its associated inequalities in West Yorkshire and Harrogate. In particular, we're looking at how we can help improve outcomes of cancer patients through early diagnosis and screening and provision of preventative advice.
Hello, I'm Rob Husband, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of the You Can Survive podcast. The focus of Season 2 is to highlight awareness and openness in talking about cancer and all things related to cancer and the effects within the ethnic minority communities. For Episode 1, I am incredibly proud to introduce the inspirational creator and the driving force behind the You Can Survive podcast, a fellow cancer champion and friend, Azuda. Welcome, and at last we get to do your podcast.
Thank you so much, Rob, for the lovely welcome, and hello everybody. So I'm sure you're already familiar with my voice from Season 1. So my name's Azu, and I'm very happy to be the first guest of Season 2 of You Can Survive, and excited to share with you all my cancer survival story.
Great. So do you want to tell us any more about yourself? What are you doing now?
Yep. So as you guys are already aware, I am a bone cancer survivor. And since the beginning-ish of the pandemic, I've been involved with a charity called Yorkshire Cancer Community, and was involved in the Cancer Smart Project, which is all about raising awareness about cancer, promoting screening. And I've been very lucky to have met Rob during this journey and have him as like my partner in bringing this podcast to life. You know, I could never have done it without his help. And other than that, professionally, I've just qualified as a pharmacist. So, that's been thank you. So that's been a part of my life, and I hope to be starting medical school in September, all going well. So that's a bit about myself. And aside from that, a bit like random, but I am a hardcore K-pop fan, and I watch a lot of Korean dramas. So if you're interested as well, then I can make recommendations. But yeah, that's a bit about me.
Well, we're doing great until K-pop came along.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's all right. I'm obviously far too old to know what K-pop is. I will have to be Googling it.
Yeah, you can do that after the podcast.
Yeah, after the podcast. So will you tell us more about how you discovered that you had cancer?
Yeah, so as I already mentioned, I am a bone cancer survivor. So I was diagnosed back in 2011 when I was 13 years old, basically had to undergo treatment for my bone cancer. So I had chemotherapy, surgery, and immunotherapy. And if I take you right to the beginning of my story, so I was just an ordinary teenager going about my life. At this point, I was in year 9, so third year of high school. And obviously, as a teenager, you have a number of things stressing you out at this point, and then you become this like competitive person. So I wanted to do well at school, and I was really into sports, especially like football, and even netball. I quite enjoyed running in general. So I was a sporty teenager, just going about my normal life and hanging around with my friends at school, until one day we had a netball tournament at school, and I was unfortunately in a team where we didn't have great players, and they were kind of depending on me, and me being me, I was a bit competitive. I wanted to win. So I remember being assigned center. If you've played netball, you'll know what I'm talking about. And so if you're center, you're having to run about a lot, Prior to that, you know, as a teenager, you do get aches or like groin pains sometimes in your legs or whatever. You know, it's something that we all have experienced at some point. So I just kind of ignored some mild pain, I'd say, I had previously in my left knee. And so this tournament came around and I was very much into the game, very competitive, trying to, you know, win the match. I don't know if we won, by the way, I can't remember. But what did happen was I developed this agonizing pain by the end of the match in my left knee. It came to the point I was literally limping and I struggled to even get back to the sports center, the changing room from the outdoors. It was pain I'd never really experienced in my entire life. And I just thought, I don't know what I've done to my leg. It wasn't really normal. It wasn't pain I'd ever experienced in my life. And I hadn't had any injury or fall during that match as well. So I was worried, but I went home that day, told my mom, like, you know, I've had this pain. It's a bit unusual. I think I need to see my doctor. Like we did discuss it because it was very severe. However, I think maybe a week went past after that whereby I was going to school as normal. I think the pain kind of settled. I had some painkillers, obviously, because you always, you know, ignore such symptoms and assume it's just growing pains or whatever. So I had maybe paracetamol, I think.
Yeah.
I was going to school as normal. But what I did find was my pain started to progress and worsen. So one of the symptoms I started to experience was whenever I'd be like in a science lab and we'd have those really tall stools, and for short people, your legs are basically dangling. So for me, that
I just thought it was stools.
There were stools, and then they were quite high. So I'm very short. So basically, what I found was when my legs were like hanging, I would get this severe like shooting pain down my left leg. Again, never experienced it before. I just couldn't tolerate it. When I went to my relative's house, I still remember getting the same pain, and I would have to bend my knee and literally sit on like my leg, like put pressure or like move. I couldn't sit still, basically. That's how bad the pain was. I'd have to move back and forth because the pain was so bad. And then it came
noticeable,
to a point.
Then is what we're saying.
Yeah.
It wasn't like an injury that
no.
You know, that would get better once you stopped playing.
No.
It was constant and it wasn't
it was constant.
Like a noticeable pain. And
yes.
Just going back to what you said about growing pains, I'm not a doctor, but I always used to think that it's a bit of a cop-out excuse for people. Or, you know, we were talking about teenage boys, any excuse not to get out of bed to go to school. I mean, that was me at that age.
Yeah.
It's growing pains.
Mm.
But as we said, you know, if it's growing pains in your left knee,
yeah,
your legs are growing at the same time.
It
bothers me that people would sort of categorize it and not take it further.
Yeah, I think with me, obviously I was experiencing the pain, and like you said, we do just categorize most times something as growing pains. However, unfortunately for me, it was more than that. But I
exactly,
think it's just what's common. We obviously can't assume everybody is going to have cancer symptoms, because luckily everybody gets cancer. But yes, at least being wary that it can happen, and not to just ignore symptoms if they are getting worse, especially.
It's so that thing, isn't it? If it keeps going,
yeah,
you seek help.
Yeah, definitely. So like what happened was I was actually getting swelling around my knee. I think that's when we started to really worry. And I went to see my GP. So he obviously assessed my knee and he said, it's probably growing pains, gave me painkillers to take for 3 weeks. 3 weeks later, obviously my symptoms didn't improve, they got worse. It got to a point where I was literally limping everywhere, and I had relatives pick up and say, you know, what's wrong with Arzu? Like, why is she limping? This isn't normal. And then my dad, obviously we went back to the GP first of all. So we went back to the GP, and this time around, he actually assessed my knee properly. He used his thumb to like press my knee, like that area that was quite swollen. And I remember just screaming because it was so painful. That pain was just excruciating. And at that point, he said, you know what, I'm worried that it might be something serious, so I'm going to refer you for an X-ray. Because I had no fall, no injury, no history of anything to suggest that, you know, there's a fracture. So why am I in pain? So he referred me for an x-ray and we were at home waiting for this referral to come through appointment. And I think it was like 2 weeks later and we had nothing, no communication from a hospital or anything for an appointment. And I was still in pain. The painkillers obviously weren't working for me. So then my dad took me to A&E. And as you're aware, if you've not had an injury, the doctors in A&E are just going to come around and say, why are you here? Like, this doesn't make sense. Just go to your GP and come around that route. But obviously we'd waited so long and it was interfering with my day-to-day life, my quality of life, even to some degree, my sleep. So I had my x-ray. The doctor just decided to agree because we were quite upset and it was, you know, affecting me very, very negatively. So I had my x-ray and he basically informed us that he saw a hairline fracture on my x-ray. Now that was unusual because I didn't have any fall, like I mentioned. If I've not had any sports injury or anything, how could I have developed a fracture? And even he was quite confused and concerned. So instead of putting a pot on, he referred me to Pinderfields Hospital in Wakefield. So I started off with Dewsbury where I had my x-ray, went to Pinderfields for an MRI scan and CT. So further investigations. So I had my MRI and I remember the consultant there come in to meet me and my mum. And he mentioned something called growth. So I was 13 back then, by the way. I don't know what a growth is. I was like, okay, what does he mean by growth? Did my bone grow abnormally? You know, that really scared me. I was always a worrier, by the way. So I started to overthink, thinking, okay, something's gone terribly wrong. My bones aren't growing as they should do. That's why I have this massive swelling. Even though if you know what growth means medically, it basically means like a tumor or it could be cancer, basically. I mean, I think he took my mom to the side, the consultant, and did tell her he's suspecting a malignancy. But obviously, I wasn't aware of anything. I was a bit confused. The only thing I was informed at the end of this whole conversation was I'm going to Birmingham, Royal Orthopaedic Hospital in Birmingham, for a biopsy. And I have no clue what a biopsy is, by the way. And unlike teenagers nowadays, I did not go on Google anything. So I went clueless, blindly to the Royal Orthopaedic Hospital in Birmingham for my biopsy. All I was told is they're going to take a sample and then they'll know what to do with me, like treat me and I'll get better. So obviously that was reassuring because the pain was taking my life away, basically.
Yeah.
So I went to Royal Orthopaedic Hospital, had my biopsy. It was, I mean, I have very bad memories, I guess, because of what came after my biopsy. So basically, I had the procedure done and we wanted to go home because usually if you've had a biopsy, it can take up to like 2 weeks for reports to come back. So I thought I'll just go home. However, the surgeon wanted to see me after my biopsy. And obviously surgeons are busy. They have surgeries to perform. And then it basically ended up being a full day in the hospital. So basically I was waiting up until 6 p.m., 6:30 p.m. in the evening for the surgeon to come speak to me and my family. And obviously if you're in the hospital and you're having to wait, it does build up that anxiety. You start to think negative things. And if a surgeon, wants to see you, that's when you're like, you know, it might be something a bit serious. It might be something scary.
Definitely so.
Yeah. So I remember I wasn't trying to think much of it. I went round to I think they had like a tea room kind of thing. So I just sat down there with like my parents. And coincidentally, I saw it was a little notice, I think, on the door. And it said, children who have bone cancer come here for surgery after chemotherapy. And at that moment, I don't know why, for someone who was clueless about everything that's going on with her, I just knew that this is about me. Like, this is wrong with me. I have cancer and I'm here now.
How did you feel then? 13 years old.
Yeah.
No one's sort of really been open with you. They've all sort of took your mum to one side. Sort of said, oh, it might. And then you sit in the tea room and then there's that big sign in front of you.
I actually don't know what I felt. I just, you know, sometimes when you can't process what's going on, what's being told, or what you're seeing. I think it was kind of like that. Obviously, at this point, we've not even spoken to the surgeon, so I was just speculating. But I think you just know. Sometimes you just know that this is going to happen. I don't know how it happens. It's just like a human instinct. And I just knew that this is the reality. And I remember the surgeon came and my parents, he spoke to my parents first. You know, when I heard my mom cry, I just knew it's
very, not good,
it's bad news. And I still remember I was shaking. I was shaking. And then they obviously called me around. Like my uncle came, he was also with us. And he said, you're going to be fine. They're just going to give you some medicine. You're going to have surgery. You'll be okay. And I'm one who can read people's faces. So when I saw my uncle, I just knew it's bad news. And then I went round and the surgeon saw me and he said, you don't look like you're sick. You don't look like you have anything wrong with you. And obviously that scares you even more. And then eventually he said that there's a tumor in your leg and that he's 99% sure it's cancerous. Now, as someone at the age of 13, especially somebody who did not even have a clue she has a tumor in her leg, to hear those words and then for him to tell me that he's 99% sure it's cancerous, it was just devastating. And I think, you know how they say when you're in like your last moments in life, like before you're going to die, your whole life replays before your eyes. I just felt like that happened to me in that moment where I just saw my entire life, my parents, my siblings, my friends, family, and I just thought, I'm going to die. Like, how can this happen? And it was more so that what's going to happen to them after I die as opposed to myself. I think you start thinking about people who are related to you, who you're a part of, like whose life you're a part of, and you start worrying for them, even though, you know, you've had this life-changing diagnosis. I couldn't think about survival at that point.
It's understandable, you know, you think about that. It's, I mean, it's, you say, you know, you didn't even know that you had a tumor.
No.
I think the thing is that at 13, any child wouldn't even think you could get a tumor in your leg.
Exactly.
If you see what I mean. It's not so much that you didn't know you had. It's the fact that, I know at my age, 13 myself, I wouldn't have been able to comprehend that's for you. To me, it would always have been lung cancer with smoke. You know, it's there's a reason you get cancer. And I always remember when I was there myself at Jimmy's and stuff, and just going what you were thinking and saying about your mum and dad and your uncle and stuff, is that the kids were always quite joyful, resilient, all in the teddy bear pajamas, all coming down for radiotherapy or chemo, whatever else. And it was the parents that looked absolutely devastated and looked, well, what can we do? And how can we do this? And the problem that comes is there any care for the parents at that time?
Yeah.
So the parents, who you're saying you don't have parents, how are your parents feeling about how they can help you?
Yeah, I remember, like, my dad was obviously devastated. My mom was distraught. Like, she was broken. And it's just heartbreaking for you as well. Like, obviously, you have this massive diagnosis to digest up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then your parents are broken. I think that was the worst for me. Like I said, when I was told, I didn't think about my life. Like, you just don't think about it. I was just worried about them. And about the cancer itself, honestly, I had never heard of bone cancer in my entire life. The only cancers I knew were leukemia, lung cancer, breast cancer, and maybe brain cancers. I wasn't aware of bone cancer. It didn't even occur to me. Like, my only exposure to cancer at age 13 was My Sister's Keeper. So I watched that movie at school. So one of the characters, she has leukemia. And I remember seeing the effect of cancer through that character, and it petrified me at that age. Like, I had nothing to do with cancer at this stage, by the way, and I was so scared by the way it was portrayed, thinking, you know, I would never want this to happen to anyone, not myself, not anybody, because it's so scary. And to come to a point where it did happen to me, obviously it's really hard to digest, especially at that age. And then, obviously, from then onwards, I did have to still wait for my final biopsy reports, as I mentioned.
And you were saying 2 weeks to get those results.
Yeah, two weeks.
That's quite a wait. You've just been delivered that news. And it's not Let's be honest, it's 99%.
That's what,
so it's
yeah,
not 100%. And then you've got another 2 weeks.
I know, and then and then you're just hanging on to that 1%. Like, we literally want you to believe that it just won't be it. And then finally, obviously, after the 2 weeks, I did. I went to LGI, Leeds General Infirmary, and that's when I had my official diagnosis from my oncologist, who I absolutely adore. Like, she was, I'm just so lucky that she was taking care of me. That's all I'm going to say. I remember how she made us all feel so comfortable when she broke the news to us, like, made sure everybody was seated. And I mean, I was kind of expecting it, even though, you know, we were hoping for better news. I don't know why. I just thought it's going to happen. Like, you just know.
You do know, you know.
Even that at that age.
Knows, yeah.
Yeah, even as a child, I just thought it is cancer, unfortunately. And so when she told me, obviously, my mum was broken. But it was in that moment I thought, I have to be strong. Like, I was upset. I did cry. I can't say I didn't cry, obviously, but I just decided I'm going to be strong and I'm going to go through this and I'm going to come out the other end. I knew it's going to be hard and I was scared. Everybody's scared. That I wouldn't give up. So, yeah, that's basically how I found out I got cancer. And before I go further into, like, my treatment, I do want to, like, emphasize to everybody that, you know, sometimes with cancer, we always associate it with old people. I mean, I think in the time now, we are talking about it a lot more than we did 10 years ago, 11 years ago when I was diagnosed. But back then, nobody would have thought a child, like, common knowledge wise, you wouldn't think a child would get cancer or something like bone cancer, which is just, it just doesn't occur to you. So, you know, let's all increase our awareness of the different cancers, because it could be an unfortunate time in your life where you could be that person who develops this rare cancer. I mean, with bone cancer, if you go on the Cancer Research UK page, if you look at the number of cases that, you know, that occur in the population every year, I think it's 550 people get diagnosed every year with bone cancer. So it is a very rare cancer. I mean, if you were to compare that to lung cancer or breast cancer, that is a very small percentage of cancers. So it basically equates to one case being diagnosed every day. Or I remember my Macmillan nurse said that in, I think, every 40 years, a GP will see one case of bone cancer. Like, that's how rare it is. So, you know, it's important to educate ourselves on the different cancers, especially those that can affect children. I mean, this is a rare cancer and it specifically occurs in children and young, like adolescents, like in your teenage years. So I think osteosarcoma, which is what I had, it specifically affects 10 to 19 year olds. But then you also have Ewing sarcoma. There's quite a few different types of bone cancers itself. So, and in terms of the symptoms, you know, I personally experienced the pain and the swelling and the fact that I was limping. And those are the main symptoms where you can get this very severe pain. Some people experience it even during the night, so it interferes with their sleep. The swelling or a lump. Now, not everybody would develop a lump. So obviously, even if you don't see an obvious lump, don't just disregard like the pain and ignore it. If it is persistent and getting worse, do get it checked by your GP, because you don't want to be in a position where it spreads elsewhere and it becomes very, very difficult to treat. We want to avoid that. So lumps, mainly lumps and bumps, that's what my oncologist would also say. You know, always keep an eye out for them. And then if it's impacting your walking, if you're limping, anything that affects your function, you know, in your day-to-day life, that is something to look out for. And then the non-specific symptoms are things like feeling tired. You know, some people may experience that, or weight loss, even though you're eating normally. Again, that could be something some patients may experience. Potential fractures or weakening of bones as well. So those are some other things to look out for, and even a fever. So they're non-specific symptoms which we can ignore, but they could be a sign of a serious condition like cancer.
That goes back to, I mean, the thing is, just highlighting that, is it's the important thing we used to say is, if you notice any change, is that any change, then that's
in your body.
You know, but people should remember that you don't, that list of symptoms, you don't have to tick all the boxes.
No.
It's if you notice a change. And I remember my voice changed for 9 months. and I didn't do anything about it for it's almost too late, as you know. So, and you know, I mean, this is the whole message of you know, the openness and the Cancer Smart message is making people aware and talking about it and everything else.
Yeah. So just to add to the point you said about not leaving things too late, obviously it affects the kind of treatment you have. So I was just going to add a bit more about the kind of treatments I had as a child.
That's what we'd like to know. I mean, from diagnosis, treatment came next.
Yeah.
And that must have been quite as equally traumatic
it was
as
horrific.
A child.
Yeah. Absolutely. I remember before I started treatment, I had to visit the ward. They just wanted to show you around. So I was 13, I turned 14. So I was to be admitted on the Teenage Cancer Trust ward, so specifically for teenagers. But because there wasn't many beds on that ward, I always ended up on the children's ward. But it's okay, that was fine.
The leader.
Yes. So I remember going to the ward, and I saw like some of the patients who'd lost their hair. I thought, I won't lose my hair. That can't happen. And then obviously I was told I am going to lose my hair. So that was news that was a little bit scary again, because I guess as a young girl, as a teenage girl, it is, you know, important to you.
One of the guys I used to chat with when we were through treatment and stuff was going, you know, chemotherapy. It's not all chemotherapy that you lose your hair over.
Oh, no.
And he told me a great story. He used to always make me smile. And I considered doing it myself.
Yeah.
And that was that he told his mates that he'd got cancer and he was going to go to treatment. And they all organised to shave their heads to come out in sympathy with him and support him and everything else.
Yeah.
And he let them do it. And then he still kept his full head of hair. And all his mates in the pub had shaved their heads.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, it was obviously good.
It does make it easier.
Them.
It definitely makes it easier.
Definitely.
And I think luckily for me, I was a bald baby. Like, I had very, very fine hair. So for the majority of my childhood, like, not majority, but like my toddler years, I didn't have a lot of hair on my head. So when I did lose my hair eventually, and my mum would always say, you look like baby Arzu. So it wasn't that bad. But that was something. So, you know, there's always a silver lining. And we didn't think of it as negatively as, you know, sometimes it can be for some people. And then did have the wonderful wigs that you get access to that literally looked so real. Nobody even could have guessed I'd lost my hair. But in terms of treatment, so like I said, I did have chemotherapy. I had immunotherapy and I had surgery. In terms of my chemotherapy, it was mainly drugs that I used in adults. So there were three main drugs they gave me: methotrexate, doxorubicin, and cisplatin. And if anybody knows anything about chemotherapy, I'd say all three of these are very, very toxic drugs with horrific side effects. One of them is vomiting, like nausea and vomiting. And the other things, like, you know, your white cell count becoming neutropenic, it was all the most common, I'd say, side effects of these drugs. And all cancer patients would be, you know, aware of how much of an impact that has on your quality of life and your functioning. Like, I remember whenever I was on chemotherapy, I wasn't able to eat anything. I struggled to even drink water. My mouth was always very, very sore, especially after methotrexate. And I'd always catch an infection and become neutropenic. So that was just my entire treatment altogether. And with bone cancer, because it's quite aggressive, the treatment, I was an inpatient for the majority of time. Like, I'd always be in the hospital. And as a young person, you don't want to be in the hospital. It's like the last place you want to be. Vomiting, personally, I think nobody likes vomiting, but for me, it was I would cry. Like, as a child, I would always cry when I'd vomit. So when I was in a situation where I had no choice but to throw up, it was the worst time of my life. I remember having so many breakdowns and just wanting to get out of the hospital. It even came to a point where I refused to go into the hospital for my chemotherapy one time because I was so traumatized by the whole experience. I don't know about you, Rob, but for children, they insert a portacath. So that's like a little, I don't know how to describe it, but it's a a line, a plastic tubing or line that inserts into your, like one of your large vessels that enters your heart. And it's to avoid the chemotherapy being injected into your normal, like, blood vessels in your arm, for example.
It does damage them.
Yeah, and as a child, they want to avoid that. So I had this portcarth fit in. It's like a piece of plastic with like a bit of jelly in the middle. And then they like insert these 1-inch needles into that device or line, I'd say. And those needles are not like your usual needles for blood tests. Those are very thick needles and they're very, very painful. Even after I had numbing cream applied, I would always feel the pain. I don't know, they didn't work for me or something. So that was also very much not my favorite part.
I can imagine. See, I was just the what's it on the hand or in the arm.
Yeah, I felt like
you just...
And this was, this is on the rib cage. Like for me, it was placed on my rib cage. So it's a very awkward position as well. So I couldn't sleep well at night and I had this toxic chemotherapy. And following that, obviously, I had my surgery at, again, the Royal Orthopaedic Hospital in Birmingham. So my surgery involved them obviously removing my tumor. They also removed like my lower leg bones, so the tibia. I'd say they removed quite a bit of it, like 2/3 of that bone, and some of my upper leg bones, so the femur, and this was all replaced with metal work. And I still remember when I was going to go for my surgery the following week, I had x-rays done beforehand. And it was at that point when I fully comprehended the kind of surgery I'm going to have, because it obviously comes with the limitations as well, like in terms of what I could do post my surgery. So I wasn't basically, I was told I'm not going to be allowed to run again. I was told that I wouldn't be able to bend my knee beyond 90 degrees. Well, you possibly could do if you really push it, but that was like the advisable target. So that was something I was informed about. And there were risks, like, you know, there could be nerve damage after the surgery. So a lot of things, major things basically, were going to come about after this surgery. But then it was more of a, you know, we need to get rid of the cancer. So at that point, you go surgery was the best option for me. And just knowing that there are people with osteosarcoma that even have to go through like amputations, I was in a very, very privileged position where I could have this surgery and have this metal work specifically made for me be inserted so that I can live a normal life. So
that was my... go with growth?
In terms of growth, so basically... I was told that every time I was going to grow, I'd have to go to the hospital again. So they'd do a tiny cut, and apparently they had a key to my leg. So they'd insert a key, they'd have some x-ray or some kind of imaging. Yeah, and then they can basically twist and grow to however long. Literally, my surgeon joked with me and he said, if you want to be 6 feet tall, I can do that for you. So that was basically about my surgery that I had in Birmingham. And then after that, I had a few more cycles of chemotherapy before my treatment came to an end. And I also received some immunotherapy, which was a newly approved drug called mifepristone at the time. So yeah, that was my main treatment. And I think just one of the things I want to say about my treatment was how much of a negative impact the chemotherapy drugs had on my body physically in terms of those short-term effects and even long-term effects that I'm living with till date, because they were toxic. I mean, some of the drugs were from like 1970s. And what I want to emphasize is the importance of research into bone cancer and the fact that we need to be raising, awareness of the cancer, fundraising for charities like Bone Cancer Research Trust, for example. They do a lot of work and research partnerships with universities that are looking into, for example, osteosarcoma or Ewing sarcoma as well, because compared to your breast cancer, for example, not enough research is being done. And that does mean children like myself back then, or teenagers, are exposed to these very, very toxic drugs. They were literally like poison. But you know, like how they say the cure is in the cause, it was that kind of situation where even though this drug could cause a secondary cancer later on, it was going to cure me at that point. So if we could all look into these charities, support them, I think that would be the best way forward to allow for more targeted therapies that are less damaging to the healthy tissue and mainly focus on getting rid of those cancer cells to be developed, especially for children as well. So yeah, that's
you're right. Well, no, I think you're right. I mean, it's slightly shocking that, you know, drugs was almost as old as I am. I mean, that were focused for adults.
Yeah.
As an adult and chemotherapy. I mean, my chemo was quite long. And they put stuff in that sort of helps other things out that would get damaged by it. Because it is effectively a poison. So, you know, it's quite an important thing to as you say, raise, because it's a less popular, not popular, but it's a less, people focus less on it.
Yeah, so I think because right, less people are
cancers that are there.
Yeah, because less people are affected by it, there's not a lot of incentive from investing in that. But we need to realise that the long-term repercussions of that treatment are still there, which would require healthcare anyway. So, you know, it's a bit about thinking about those cancers as well.
You're right. So, surgery, always fun, as I can recall. I joke, it's pretty crap, really. So it is quite invasive wherever you have it, because it's always to remove something.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about how that surgery and the resulting physical disabilities, how did that affect you as a young person, sort of mentally and physically, really?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I had something called an endoprosthetic knee replacement. And as a result of this surgery, I personally went on to develop something called a drop foot. So it's usually because of nerve damage. I am no longer able to pull my foot up as you would be able to normally, like I've lost that function. And that does obviously have an impact on your day-to-day activities in terms of walking. You know, I've had a lot of people sometimes notice that, you know, I'm walking a bit different, and they immediately think that something's wrong with my foot when it was nothing to do with my foot, but that was obviously a consequence of my surgery. And aside from that, because of the metalwork, I now have restricted knee bend. I'm not allowed to run or like twist, because you don't want to obviously damage the metalwork. So there's a lot of, I guess, I mean, I don't like to use this word, but there are limitations, like they say, to what I am allowed to do. I mean, I potentially could do all of that, but you know, there's always going to be a risk of damaging the metalwork or doing something that I don't or I can't afford, really. So, you know, it was a lot to comprehend and accept as a young person. I mean, I didn't really understand the extent to which this surgery is going to change my life. Like I said, you know, I was really into sports, running especially. You know, I was one who, I'm very impatient, so waiting for lifts is not my thing. I was one to take the stairs always, okay? But now I am the person who has to use a lift, and I find it so frustrating, A, that I have to take a lift from C floor to D floor, for example, like one flight of stairs. And I sometimes do get stares as well from people thinking, are you really going to take a lift for one flight of stairs? And I'm just like, this is the problem with having an invisible disability or hidden disability that people don't realize. And they just assume everything is fine on the exterior. I mean, we always say this about cancer survivors, you know, once your hair's grown out, everything's back to normal. And honestly, I really wish that was the case, but unfortunately it's not. You're a completely different person. You know, you've been rewired and, you know, put together in a completely different ratio, shape or form after treatment. You know, you have this new normal again that people realized after COVID, but we've been exposed to that new normal reality way before that, after our diagnosis. So definitely it was about me getting used to this new normal. Going back to school, for example, with girls asking me, you know, what happened? What kind of surgery did you have? You know, all those questions as a young teenager, it's too much. You know, you're worried about what people are thinking about you. So it definitely did take a toll on my mental health, which I will talk about later. It was later on that it really affected my mental health. But yeah, when I was going through rehab, it's hard, you know, having to do physiotherapy while on chemotherapy or intensive physiotherapy. I had to go back to Birmingham for that. It was a lot that was required of me to get to the function I'm at today. Even though, you know, I did all that, I still do have a bit of a limp. So that's always going to be there. It was something I was told before surgery. But, you know, you do get people always wondering, like, maybe if you did a bit more physiotherapy or exercise, that wouldn't be there. But unfortunately, they don't understand the level of surgery you've had and the trauma that your body's gone through, that, you know, the fact that I'm functioning, I'm back on my two legs and doing what I can do in life, you know, it is a big achievement. So, yeah.
It must be hard. I mean, especially so young with that, as you say, it's an invisible disability as such, because it's covered. You know, I can't, like, tomorrow, because we've talked a lot today, my voice will be very croaky, very weak, and I can't hide that.
Yeah.
And I always get people start looking in my eyes.
Yeah.
And then you can slowly see them start looking.
Yeah.
Down to my throat, where there's this great big scar, and then you can see them going. And it's, and when you, well, I've said before, you know, people go, have you got cold?
Yeah.
And you know, depending on my mindset on the day, it's, oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Or I just don't answer. And if I'm really feeling quite sort of, what's it to the world, I'll just go, no, it's cancer. And then I feel bad that everyone goes, oh, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. And then I think, well, why did you ask me?
Yeah.
You know?
And I just want to add to that, that is something I can relate to at so many levels. But with me, it's more of a, in the winter months, my metalwork gets quite stiff sometimes. I limp a bit more, or it becomes a bit more obvious. I don't think a lot of people realize actually now, but But when you do have the stiffness in your metalwork and you start limping, I've had people sometimes stare at me, like look down, or they'd just be like, are you okay? Like in a positive, like they're trying to say it out of, you know, what is it? Like they're worrying for you, basically. They want to show care, whatever it is. But because you've gone through all that trauma and, you know, you just don't want to, you don't even think about your disability. Like sometimes that happens to me. I don't even think about it. And then I'm just like, oh, okay. Yeah, I'm fine. Nothing's wrong. Or like you said, sometimes I've actually been brave enough to say like, well, I have cancer. Like that is the first time I did that in my 20s. I would never have done that as a teenager. I would always say I'm fine. Nothing's wrong. Nothing happened. I didn't have cancer. Like that was me. And
there's
then,
that stigma, isn't there?
Yeah.
You're meant to feel ashamed that you had it. When you are in treatment, everyone knows when you're 6, 12, 18 months out of treatment, you're still suffering.
Yeah.
And you're still having problems. And even longer, it goes on probably for the rest of our life, there will be some effect there. So going back to the treatment or the post-treatment and during treatment, because within the community, how did you think that the disability and the diagnosis sort of affected it? How were you perceived? Mm-hmm. In the community, because this part of this is about ethnic minorities and raising awareness in the ethnic minority communities.
Yeah.
So there must have been some difficulty, shall we say?
Yeah. Obviously, like as a South Asian, there are a lot of things that we don't openly talk about within my community. So, you know, things like mental health, things like even periods, as, you know, normal as that might sound to you, menstruation, we don't talk about that openly, or cancer is included, and physical disability. You know, a lot of the times this is, there's a lot of the negativity, the stigma, associating it with something negative at all times. Like, you know, if you hear of someone who had cancer, A, people would look or perceive you as somebody who's weak, somebody that they'd basically feel sorry for. And as someone who's diagnosed with cancer, and you will understand this as well, you don't want the pity. You don't need that pity. You're still that same person, but it can really bring you down. But that's just the way it's viewed in my community. And physical disability as well, you know, it's seen as a, if something's wrong with you, that's a weakness. That's like a minus point now, you know, you're not as you were before. You're not as good as X, Y, Z person. You know, that's just an unfortunate reality. I would say in terms of my own personal experience, the main thing I experienced was my parents being quite fearful about speaking about my cancer and sharing it with the wider, you know, connections that we had. Like they were happy to share it with their siblings. Like my family, like my extended family did know, but the details and the ins and outs my parents didn't want to discuss, not because they had an issue as such. They were very supportive and they cared for me like no one could have ever done. I think parents obviously going to do whatever they can for their children, but I think they were worried about what people might come around and say that could hurt me or even upset them, because it's just a harsh reality of my community at times that we sometimes can say things that are insensitive. Maybe the intention isn't negative. You know, I have to say we did receive a lot of support from my extended family members. They helped us through the entire cancer journey and we've been so lucky. But there's always that fear that, you know, what if somebody comes around and, like, from my parents' perspective, they're worried that they might just say something that could make me feel very inferior, you know, and negative about the fact that this is my reality, that I had cancer or that I had this disability and I walk a bit different. You know, I think some of the South Asians, like I know, one of the things that they may worry about with my kind of diagnosis or any kind of physical disability that's obvious on the like exterior is people judging you and talking about you and saying that you're different, you know, being different and standing out. I think even I was one of those people. It's always a bit negative because people are going to talk about you, focus on you, not always positive talk as well. And that obviously scares you and prevents you from wanting to be open. However, I think what I've learned over time, and this is a growth like journey my parents experienced with me, is that we've tried to overcome that fear and be more open about my experience, to, you know, speak up about my diagnosis even, or the surgery I've had. You know, like my mom is very open and she would say, you know, she's gone through X, Y, Z or this kind of surgery and look now, we're doing great. I'm back to normal. I'm walking as I used to walk. I'm going to work. I worked full time. I've got my degree. You know, I'm doing everything like a normal girl my age would have achieved or even not have achieved, who knows. But it's more of a that fear of people, like, what will people say? That's literally a saying in my community. Like, what will people say if they find out X, Y, Z? But it's about time we tackle that stigma and talk about cancer, like we said, or even talk about physical disability that can come with cancer. So, yeah,
it's has bad, been.
Yeah. I mean, I've been very lucky, I will add, like with my parents, they've never, ever made me feel like I can't do something. Like, they've pushed me to, you know, go for the goals I've set myself. If it's, you know, hopefully now going to medical school, they've said, if that is what you want to do, if it makes you happy, we will support you. And I wish everybody has that environment and support. Yeah, it does. It does help.
You need that support. I mean, the thing that strikes me is that, you know, you're talking about being judged physically, not the fact that at 13, 14 years old, you were brave, strong, dignified, and you've tackled something that nobody should tackle. No. And you're not, people wouldn't go, wow. People would go, you walk a bit funny.
Yeah.
You have a bit of a limp. And and it's a bit saddening. But, you know, it'll change and things will change. And it's sometimes every community, I think,
puts
that into place as well. And everyone's judged. We all have to be, you know, I mean, I agree. I know what you're saying. I feel very conscious of the fact that I now effectively have a misshapen face. And that's a result of the treatment.
Yeah.
And some days you do look in the, when you sort of shave and look in the mirror and you think, I don't really want to go out today and have pee. And it is sort of noticeable, but it's not so bad when you... You're my age through life, but at 14, 13, 14, 15 and beyond, there's more to seeing it than what people think about your walk.
Yeah, and I just want to say, like, for anybody who's listening, who's maybe in a similar situation to me, like 10 years ago, who are going through treatment or might have a physical disability and are from a South Asian or any background for that matter, that, you know, let's not live our life to please others or be the way they think is the way you should be. You know, accept yourself for the way you are, even with your flaws. Like, that makes you beautiful. That makes you you, as cliche as this sounds. But the day you accept yourself, the whole world will start to love you and appreciate you, because there's more to Azudar than her exterior body. It's about who I am on the inside. And I think everybody needs to learn this. Like you said, we need to change the dialogue, as opposed to feeling sorry for someone or saying, you're different, you walk a bit funny, X, Y, Z. We want to say, look, this is a sign, that scar is a sign of your bravery or your survival story, or the fact that you overcame this challenge in life that not everybody does overcome. And, you know, if we start talking about cancer like this, physical disabilities like this, it can really transform the world we live in and make it a more positive place, really, for everybody.
Absolutely. I cannot agree any more with that. That is, yeah, the perfect statement. I mean, I always believe, particularly now, is that nobody should spend a life looking back. You should always just be looking forward.
Yeah.
But still. So, we've talked already about mental health. I know that you've struggled with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think everyone would be interested if you were brave enough to share a little bit more.
Yep. So
how it affected you and still affects you.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the treatment was very traumatic. The diagnosis was traumatic, but I'd say for the most part, I was very positive throughout. You know, anytime I was feeling better and well in myself, I'd do something creative because I just enjoyed that. So I'd do something crafty or paint or whatever. But then it was 5 years down the line, I think, in 2016, when my mental health started to deteriorate. And I think it came to a point where I fully sort of realized what had happened to my body. So it was during my gap year. I'd done my GCSEs, I'd done my A-levels, and then I was on my gap year. And I think that's when it hit me that I had cancer and I have this physical disability. You know, this is the effect it's had on me. I'm going to have these echoes, so like heart scans, the chest x-rays, leg x-rays for the rest of my life on a regular basis. And that's my reality. And that maybe, you know, one day my cancer could come back. Like, all those fears just crept in and I just felt devastated. I felt like day after day, my mental health started to deteriorate. I wasn't feeling like myself. I felt detached from my surrounding. In fact, just 2 days ago, I found like a little diary I kept in my gap year. And I have like mini reflections of how I felt lonely and just alone. 5 years down the line, 5 years down the line, you know, I was feeling this way because even though you have your friends, you have your family, nobody really understands your experience. You're on your own. You could have this whole support system, but when it comes to mental health, unfortunately, you come to a point where you do feel alone and lonely. I felt like nobody really understood my physical disability. I mean, I've been very, very lucky that my mom, like, I was able to share a lot with her. And even till now, she's like my personal counselor. Like, I'd go to her with any worry, anything on my mind, be it about cancer, about work, about any aspect of my life. But even then, sometimes it's very hard for you to even share things with them because you don't want to upset your family. And then you're on your own, you're suffering, you're late nights at 4 a.m. in the morning, you're just thinking about all these things that you fear in the future. Like, obviously nobody's promised tomorrow, but it's just a natural part of life, especially with cancer. But I think that trauma just really took a toll on me at that point. And I think that's when my whole mental health journey started. And
it's that 5 years thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
4 or 5 years. Yeah. 5 years clear and you go into
remission. That's when you worry. That's when you get scared.
That's when you start worrying because you have the people around you, because you begin to socialise with people that have cancer. And particularly during the pandemic, there was all these social groups online. I was with, you know, we both, that's how we met.
Yeah.
You know, they're all there. And then people stop coming. And it isn't because they don't want to come anymore.
No.
It's because it's come back.
Yeah, all that. And literally, I just before this call, I looked at the statistics for bone cancer because I remember doing that during treatment. And if you look at the survival rate for osteosarcoma, which is what I had, it's like 40% five-year survival. So that is very scary because now it's like 10 years down the line. And I know people would tell me to celebrate and be happy, but it's just really difficult because the more you go further into your survival journey, the scarier it becomes because you're worried.
Exactly.
What if this happens? What if this goes wrong? Is my leg okay? You know, your mental health, like I said, for me, I developed anxiety. I had some episodes of depression as well. And I just, even though I was physically okay now, I didn't have the will to live at some points, you know, and that is very, you know, upsetting for me to say. And some people might come around and say, you know, how could you say that you're so lucky to have been given this second chance at life? You know, you need to appreciate it more. And that whole toxic positivity comes around, but it's like, it's not as simple as that. You're so traumatized. You're so disturbed. You're having to accept so much, even so far into your journey, that you actually come to a point where you're like, you know, am I even living the life that I was given a second chance at properly? Do I even deserve it? I've had times where I had this survivor's guilt where I felt like maybe somebody else who's not with us today deserves this life more than I do, because my mental health was so terrible that I felt like, you know, is it worth me even living?
But you're not alone in that. You're not alone. I mean, I know what you're saying. You know, I've seen, but you'd see people that would never make the complete journey, and it would be, are they deserving of it and everything else? And I know what you're saying about how we feel and everything else, and what people react, oh, you've got a second chance and all this and all that.
Yeah.
We don't feel like this all the time.
No.
But you are bombarded with information and you're bombarded with statistics.
Mm.
And it's not like you will be given a book. Oh, read this book, read this leaflet, and you read it, and that's when you see 40% of people survive 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, I'm one of these, and how many? And then when you're not sleeping because your whole sleep pattern changes, that's when at 3 a.m, you're laid there wide awake thinking it's going to come back. And this isn't every day, you know, and then you'll start getting something will change and you panic, and it does. It never, I'm a great believer in the fact that we survive it and you survive it every day for the rest of your life. But you know, it's important that people, it's very brave that you're talking this way, because people, we both know there'll be a lot of people having exactly the same thoughts, thinking exactly the same way, and by you saying these things, hopefully it'll allow them to go and speak to a family member or a friend in the same way. They'll receive the understanding that you received. And I think it's important to reiterate this, that as a South Asian person, how easy was it to actually open up about your mental health to your family more than anything?
Yeah.
You know, it's all right to say you've done it, but there must have been that step on how to make that move.
Yeah, so obviously I think it was very difficult for me to even understand my own feelings at that point. Like, I had some panic attacks, and then obviously my parents knew something isn't right. And like I said, my mum was very understanding. But I would say from my experience, you know, my dad's been very supportive, but there were times where he wasn't able to fully comprehend my experience with my mental health struggles. You know, at times he'd just say to me, you know, Azu, you need to toughen up. You can't cry now. You know, you're a grown adult now. Like, even till now, sometimes I do have my breakdown. So because mental health is a whole different journey that I'm on. But it's always about, you know, being tough and getting through life. And, you know, you can't cry. You're an adult. This isn't like, you know, you're not a child anymore. So you have to be in control of your feelings. And one of the things I really feel is that's not true, because you could be a very, very strong, brave person, but still feel what you feel, and your feelings are valid. It's nothing for you to be ashamed of. It's nothing for you to hide away from, or, you know, bottle up within you. I always think that's the worst way to deal with your mental health, is to keep everything inside, repress your feelings, because it comes out and affects your physical health. And we don't want that to happen. And I think as a South Asian, the main issue I'd say within my community is that, again, we view mental health very negatively. I mean, sometimes, you know, people with mental health conditions, they're referred to as being like crazy, and like very negative words come out of you know, our mouths, which is not the way it should be talked about. We need to think of it from the perspective of that person, that they're still who they are. Like, you know, even though I have anxiety, I'm still Azu. I still have my interest. You know, I still like K-pop. I still watch my K-dramas. I still, I don't know, want to build my career in whatever field I'm going to go into. I still love my family, care for them, and want to, you know, do amazing things in life. That doesn't take away from those aspects of me. And I could be all of that with my anxiety. So it's about time we take away that negative dialogue and that negativity surrounding it. And I know not everybody is going to be lucky to have parents like myself. I mean, I did mention my dad did struggle to understand my experience, but I think, again, over time, it's been a bit of a journey for him as well. He's been more understanding of how I might be feeling, even though he hasn't necessarily experienced it himself. It's more of a becoming aware that this can happen, that this is what this person is experiencing, and that, you know, we should respect their feelings and support them as opposed to give advice. I mean, within my community, one of the things I personally don't like is when something goes wrong, a lot of people come around and start giving advice, like, you could do this and this would solve this problem, or, you know, like, you did this, that's why this happened. If you did it this way, this would happen. Yeah. Like, it will be a positive outcome. But the important thing is that at that moment, the person who is struggling, going through some kind of hardship or mental health, you know, struggles, they just need somebody to listen to them. Just be there, just listen, don't exactly. say a word. And that makes a whole all world difference. Yeah. And I just yeah. hope whoever's listening to this, if you know anybody who's going through a mental health condition, as well as somebody, you know, who also has cancer, or if you just want to learn something new and share it with our community or anybody, you know, anybody who may benefit from learning about mental health, is that do whatever you can to listen to someone, to check up on them. You know, ask them, how are you? And don't just ask it once, ask it twice or three times, because it might be the third time that person finally musters the courage to share what they're feeling. I know my mum does this to me quite a bit. She'll ask me twice, three times, and then eventually I'll open up. She'll have to push me to share my feelings. But it made a huge difference to me in terms of the fact that I have overcome my struggles with anxiety. Like, it was really bad 5 years ago. And now I'm able to do this podcast without feeling the anxiety I might have felt. I'm able to talk about my cancer without crying, because there was a point I'd always cry when I mentioned, I couldn't even say the word cancer. I'd say big C. I can't say the word cancer. And the fact that
I wouldn't give him that. It was always little C to me.
Little C. Yeah. So it's a journey of growth and healing, I'd say. So, you know, if you're listening, I hope you can spread positivity, listen to people who are struggling, support them, check up on them, and make the effort, make the pledge to, you know, convert this conversation into something positive.
Accentuate the you in when you ask them, how are you?
Yes.
It's actually, how are you today? That's the important thing. So time's drawing on, and I think it's time for us to wind this up today, because it's been an absolute pleasure to do this. This has got to be my second favourite. Obviously, my favourite podcast is mine.
All right.
Okay. No, I'm joking. Yours, this has been a pleasure. This has been my favourite one. It has been some time in coming. I know that you were always anxious about doing it, and it's wonderful that you are actually doing it. So I'm going to draw this to a close now of season two. Back for season two, episode one, the first podcast is done, in the bag.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
No, thank you for allowing me to be present to listen to the story, because I did know most of it, but it's wonderful to hear you actually talk openly about it.
So, before we fully close this conversation, I just want to quickly go through like the signs and symptoms of bone cancer to reiterate them. So, you know, if anybody you know or even yourself have been experiencing any sort of unusual new pain that is quite severe, especially in the night and it's affecting your sleep, or if you have any kind of swelling or lump or bump in your knees, your other joints, for example, or anything that's affecting your walking, you know, please take those symptoms seriously, especially if you know a child or a teenager is experiencing this, because bone cancer mainly affects that particular age group or young adults. So, you know, be aware of your bodies, look out for these symptoms, because sometimes it's not growing pains. Sometimes it's not just a random ache and pain. It can be something quite serious or significant. And if you want to find out more information, do visit the NHS Choices website, the Cancer Research UK website, or the Bone Cancer Research Trust website. And we will share the links to those in the podcast description. So yeah, thank you so much again, Rob.
No, thank you. It's good to get that point across as well, because people do need to, as we say, no consider change. Get it checked out and hopefully reduce treatment times. Brilliant. Thank you for your time. I will speak to you very soon. Take care.
Thank you. This podcast is brought to you by the West Yorkshire and Harrogate Cancer Alliance and patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. To find out more, visit us on our website. That's www.yorkshirecancercommunity.co.uk/cancersmile. Thank you.